before we begin, we're going to do a little demonstration of how we keep time since we're doing Zoom. When it's time to begin, you will see a green card, excuse me, that says start. When you have 5 minutes to go, you will see a yellow card that says 5 minutes. And when it's time to stop, you will see a red card that tells you to stop. I will help you keep track of it because it will always be in the upper left-hand corner. But when you're involved in an argument and what you're planning to say, sometimes it's hard to keep track of that. When the red sign comes up, I will let you finish answering a question that's pending, but I will likely pull you in right after that. So we are going to follow the time limits as much as possible. Now, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Very good. Okay. Then I'll call our case for the morning, State versus Chambers. Attorney Rosen, please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Mark Rosen appears on behalf of the petitioner, DeCarlos Chambers. It's pretty clear from the facts of this case that the trial counsel and Bowie violated the standards of McCoy versus Louisiana. She told the jury, as the court has read through my briefs, that to consider convicting her client of second degree reckless homicide. She gave facts to argue that. She gave specific facts about, I looked through it before in my brief, how this is dark. The shot spotter couldn't determine who fired the shots first. Shots were going back and forth. She told them to consider convicting her client of a crime that he had specifically indicated before court she would not accept, and he would not accept.
Yes, counsel, ma'am. Do you believe an in the alternative argument is consistent with McCoy? So, lawyer says, and just put aside from the facts of this case for a minute, I'm interested in your sort of abstract answer to this question. That is, my client didn't do it. My client wasn't there. But if you think he was, he certainly can convict him of the greater charge. You could only at best convict him of the lesser charge. Do you believe triggers a McCoy type violation?
Yes, when the client has clearly and adamantly, as in this case, which was before court at the final pretrial, when Ms. Bowie specifically told the trial court he didn't do anything wrong, he's not pleading guilty to anything, and he specifically turned down the charge that she later told the jury to consider convicting, and she specifically told the court he's not pleading guilty to anything, he's going to trial, he didn't do anything, that specifically violates McCoy. McCoy indicates, in that case, the lawyer was English, could not interfere with McCoy's telling the jury, I was not the murderer, quote unquote, in any way, shape, or form. McCoy is broad in that list. And it also says, presented with express statements of the client's will to maintain innocence, counsel may not steer the ship in any other way. That's at 138 Supreme Court 1509. So that's clearly
Attorney Rosen, I don't want to interrupt. It's hard with Zoom. I do want to follow up on what Justice Hagedorn said. So what is counsel to do when there's a lesser included offense? Not say anything about it? I mean, again, he had asked the question. I think it was a well-worded question. Put aside the facts of your client's case. What is under your reading of McCoy, a defense attorney couldn't discuss a lesser included instruction? Which is before the jury. What could an attorney do under your reasoning?
Well, if the client specifically adamantly maintains his innocence under McCoy, the attorney, because as McCoy said, the client is the captain of the ship, the attorney can only argue for absolute innocence. That's what McCoy says. So basically, when the client specifically says, I'm innocent, I didn't do this, I'm not pleading guilty to the lesser included, as happened in this case here, and it's pretty clear on the record, then the attorney has to clearly state he didn't do it and just argue for that. It's not the client's case. It's as McCoy clearly says, it's the client's life. It's his case. It's his Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. Now, clearly, if the client and the attorney have discussed this before court and have made it on the record and there's some inferences, some notes, maybe not even on the record, that says the client has authorized me to argue for this, then that's a different thing. But in the absence of that, the attorney must strictly follow what the client tells him to do and the client's edicts and the client's assurances and the client's representation, what the client wants. And that's clearly what McCoy was all about, is basically it's a little more blatant in McCoy, where the client was hollering away through the trial and basically, and the attorney clearly said, he was the murderer, a little more fervently than here. But here, I think it's pretty clear that she functionally told the jury that he was the murderer, that he was a shooter, and to consider convicting. I think the clear word is consider convicting my client of second-degree reckless homicide, when there had been clear assurances, affirmations by the client, I didn't do it. That's somebody else. Somebody else was the shooter. I'm not pleading guilty to anything, even including second-degree reckless homicide, which, as indicated in my brief in the record, was what was offered to him before trial. He specifically said, I'm not taking this deal. I'm not pleading guilty to anything of that specific charge that she later on said, Ms. Bowie said at trial in closing arguments, you should consider convicting my client of that. It's clearly, in my opinion, Your Honor, a violation of McCoy. And any time, to go the broader, the abstract theory, any time that the client says, I didn't do it, you have to stick with that and just argue not guilty. It's not the attorney's choice. I mean, it's not the attorney's life on the line. His job is to do what the client wants, as we all know from prior practice.
Counsel, are you aware of any courts that have interpreted McCoy the way you're reading it? I know that there's at least some courts who have not. The Ninth Circuit has a case where they say that, and in the alternative argument is perfectly consistent with McCoy, that McCoy's about, hey, we're going to forsake the opportunity of acquittal in the hopes of obtaining a lighter sentence. And that's a very different situation than saying, hey, my client didn't do it, but even if you think he was there and the one, you can't convict him of the greater offense, that's fine. In that case, it was a self-defense argument in the alternative, but in the Ninth Circuit case. But are you aware of any other courts that have read McCoy the way you're reading it, that in the alternative argument is not consistent with it?
Well, I read a case. There was a case. It was Louisiana versus Horn, which said, holding McCoy is very broadly written and focuses on a defendant's autonomy to choose the objective of defense. The jury was talked about finding a lesser included. It's Horn. I'm looking at the article. It's U.S. versus, it's Louisiana versus Horn. It came out after 2018. I'm just reading a legal profession blog from September 17, 2018. Other than that, I didn't really go into that far of depth, Your Honor, in terms of that. I just think McCoy applies in the situation given what happened. So that's about the only thing I can tell the court.
Counsel, you just advanced that the defense attorney here argued, quote, you should consider convicting my client of this. I think the words actually are, quote, and I think under these circumstances, the second degree reckless, that does not include utter disregard for human life, is something you should consider. Tell me where I'm wrong on this. I read the transcript and I took that in context to mean, really, even if you consider the second degree reckless, that the defendant is not guilty, and in part not guilty because of the standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. As I read the transcript of the closing argument, I noted that the defense counsel tried to disparage the eyewitness testimony, saying the main witness was lying, the video didn't show what it did, what it the state purports it to show, the brother had a motive. And so she begins with beyond a reasonable doubt and ends with, so find my client not guilty, after having argued reasonable doubt. So is it correct to say, as you advance, that defense counsel said, you should consider convicting my client of this?
Well, I think when you tell the jury that you should consider a second-degree reckless homicide as a lesser included, I think that's pretty clearly an inference that you should consider convicting him of this, because the standards don't meet the requirement. Because the only thing she indicated to about that was this does not include the utter disregard for human life. But she did say something you should consider. I don't know how you could. I apologize. Please, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. Maybe it's just the way I'm reading it. But when you say somebody says you should consider this, it says you should consider convicting my client of this. And then she gave all these reasons down here in the paragraph below, the shooting in the dark, when somebody's shooting a gun already, overlapping shots, one person shoots and the other person doesn't know who's shooting first, does not support first degree reckless homicide. So basically what she was basically talking about there, in my position, in my opinion, is that the standards did not meet first degree reckless homicide, but met the second degree reckless homicide. And that's something they should consider in terms of convicting. What they should do with the client is to convict him instead of the first-degree reckless homicide. I think the inferences, and I think a jury could reasonably infer that and come to that conclusion, that you're saying, okay, we will you told us to consider convicting your guy of second-degree reckless homicide, and lo and behold, that's what happened. And that's how I read it, Your Honor. And I don't mean to be, that's my opinion, is that when she says you should consider this lesser charge, I don't see it. In my opinion, there's no other explanation for why you should consider this lesser charge except to consider finding my client guilty of that lesser charge. That's kind of how I read that whole paragraph, that whole portion of
the
closing arguments.
Thank you.
No problem, Your Honor. Thank you. So I think that it's my opinion, you know, before this.
Counsel?
I'm sorry.
So as a practical matter, I'm just trying to think back on a number of trials that I've had in the past where sometimes for strategic reasons, it seems pretty obvious that counsel is not going to argue much about certain claims or accounts that are brought, but will focus on making sure their client is not convicted of a more serious charge. Right. And it's a bit of a strategy to employ in trying a case to say, you know, we're really not, this is what happened. And my client agrees this is what happened, but my client disagrees that this happened and really is going for a conviction, perhaps on lesser counts, but focusing on a lack of proof on the greater count. Should a trial judge before trial create a record on what the strategy is and pin them down in that regard? Or how exactly would you have the court proceed to make sure that counsel is appropriately acting? Or is your rule really that no matter what, you have to contest every single possible count?
Well, I think when the client makes it crystal clear that he or she didn't do it, then the attorney, based upon McCoy, has to abide by that and basically say he or she didn't do it. I mean, I've done what you've said many times, Your Honor, argue for the lesser included in my trials, but those were all before McCoy. And I think McCoy sets a new playing field. Back then, I believe, is a prejudicial and ineffective assistance of counsel standard. And now under McCoy, I think you have to look at it as just a structural error. I think that's how McCoy presented it. So I think that what would need to happen is if there's going to be a hearing about it, there needs to be, I don't know if there needs to be a record. I think in this case, there was a record made. Ms. Bowie clearly made the record that my client didn't do it. He's pleading not guilty to anything. He's not taking any deal. I think a combination of some sort of a Ludwig hearing where the offer is presented to the attorney says, my client didn't do this. He says he didn't do this, but that sort of thing, that sort of would be clearly on the record where that sort of statement is made. I think this sort of strengthens the argument that you should have a Ludwig hearing in every case. And maybe right before trial, there can be some more discussions about that. You know, you have the deal here. Are you taking, no, my client didn't do it. He's pleading not guilty. He didn't do anything. Is that correct, Mr. Defendant? And then just go from there. And then that would make the record. And if there's not going to be a Ludwig hearing, I think the attorney should strictly document in his notes what exactly the discussions were. So if there's a hearing later on and the client attorney has to testify, then he can say, well, we talked about it and this was what I was authorized to do. And this is what he told me. But I think the attorney, it strengthens the need for a Ludwig hearing where that it would, all that sort of issues would be clearly brought out at forefront and basically discussed about and brought about just so we don't have to have this sort of a thing happen again, Your Honor.
Except that might tie defense counsel's hands or show their cards before trial. I mean, sometimes strategically, I think defense counsel and the defendant benefit from not necessarily revealing the entire strategy of their defense ahead of time. I see why you want it in this case. I'm just concerned about the unintended consequences of other cases.
Well, I think McCoy only applies when it's a crystal clear affirmation by that I am absolutely innocent and I didn't do this. And then that's the only time McCoy applies. So I don't think if the attorney is going to go to trial, and you know, I've been in that situation before where my client, you know, clients have said, I'm not keeping to this, and you're on your, you know, you can go with it. I'm not taking that deal. It's, you know, it's the old defense of, you know, I don't like the plea offer type of a defense. That's one thing. But when the client affirmatively and adamantly says, I didn't do this and I'm pleading not guilty to anything, as in this case, then McCoy applies. And that's where I think that it would be. It's basically when McCoy applies is the issue. And I think the issue only applies is when there is clear record during the trial. My client is absolutely innocent. Attorney client says, I didn't do this. I'm not pleading guilty to anything. I want a trial because I want to walk out of here. I didn't do anything wrong. And that's when we have the issue of McCoy applying. And that's the only time the issue of McCoy would apply. I think that's
Mr. Rosen, if I understand your reading of McCoy and what you're asking us to do here, what you really, I think, are asking us for a bright line rule that if a defendant is maintaining his or her innocence, the defense attorney can't talk about the substantive jury instructions. And then what's going to happen is that the jury is going to go back in the jury room with a big packet of jury instructions. And the only point of view that they're going to have regarding the substantive jury instructions is what the prosecutor had said. That seems to me to be ineffective on its face.
Well, what the attorney can talk about is a greater jury instruction, guilty or not guilty on that, as Ms. Bowie did to a certain extent here, saying, you know, he didn't meet, there wasn't reckless disregard for human life, that sort of thing. You know, he's not guilty because they, government didn't prove less, the greater offense. They didn't prove the lesser offense. They didn't prove this because it doesn't meet this requirement because he didn't do it. He wasn't there. His brother had a motive. They didn't prove the greater offense because there's no reckless disregard for human life, that sort of thing. And then the jury can go back there and say, well, the prosecutor talks about first-degree reckless homicide and possibly second-degree reckless homicide, but the attorney for the client says they didn't meet any of the elements. The attorney discussed the elements, and they haven't met any of the elements for anything here, and you have to let my client go on a not guilty, period. So I think that under McCoy, when that is the situation that is where the client says, I didn't do it and I'm not guilty, then that is what basically a defense counsel is required And that's all he or she is required to do is just basically argue why the elements haven't been met for anything, whether it's a lesser included. I mean, once again, in this case, the state is the one who requested the second degree reckless homicide, not Ms. Bowie, not the defendant. And I think that's where it has to go. Is the attorney would just have to go on closing argument during trust, and my client didn't do it. Here's why. Here are the elements of anything, lesser included, greater, everything, and this is why he's not guilty, and you should let him go. And that's basically what, because that's what McCoy, I think, requires. It says that the attorney is just works for the client, presented with express statements of the client's will to maintain innocence. Counsel may not steer the ship in any other way. That's what I just read. And I think that's what the trial counsel cannot interfere with McCoy's telling the jury, quote, I was not the murderer. I did it with the lesser included. Not that I was not of sound mind. I was not the murderer. And that's where basically McCoy, because that's what the Sixth Amendment says. And I think under the light of McCoy, I don't think there's any sort of ineffective assistance of counsel issue with that, because all you're doing is, as attorney is doing, is just following what your client is requiring you to do under the Sixth Amendment.
Attorney Rosen, I first apologize that my video has not been great, but I've heard everything as I've kind of been going in and out, I hear. But I do want to follow up on something that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley had asked. When she read the transcript, clearly there's a way to read this differently than you're reading it. So my question to you is, to what extent do we have to look at the entirety of what was said and not pick apart a sentence that you read one way that we might read differently? To what extent do we have that obligation in looking at the entirety of the oral argument and what was said?
Well, clearly, I think the court it's free to do what it's on its own. I'm just reading it as the way I see it is when she says you should consider, it's pretty clear. There's a lot that she doesn't say use the word convicting, but it's pretty clear that she's saying you should consider this. It's clearly you should consider convicting my client of the second degree reckless homicide, because the standards don't meet that of first degree reckless homicide, because there's not the utter disregard for human life. And then she goes on and argues why there's no utter disregard for human life. And she says does not support first degree reckless homicide. But she said you should consider the second degree reckless homicide. When you go back to the eliminations, I think that saying you should not consider first degree reckless homicide, but you should consider convicting my client of second degree reckless homicide because of these reasons. And then she went on as Judge Bradley said, there's some issues about some other person doing it and you know, why there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But I think that was and I think Ms. Bowie threw this in there in the middle to try and nullify its effects. But I think that when you're saying to the jury, you should consider a crime when you think about it, I think that's, to me, I read that as saying you should consider convicting my client of that lesser included offense. That's what I'm urging and asking the court to find, because I think that to me is a pretty clear reading of the transcript, is that's the inference there, is that you should consider convicting him of that lesser included offense. I hope I answered your question, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you.
Counsel, we have been focusing on the consider language that is found on page 35 of the transcript of the closing arguments of defense counsel. I want to shift attention, however, to page 34, where defense counsel specifically mentions the name of Kyle Wary, and kind of seems to suggest by that whoever shot him at dark at night can't be held in utter disregard. By by saying whoever shot him, does that open the door for the possibility of your client being the one who shot him?
I think so. I mean, she doesn't quite lay down and say that, you know, my client's the one that shot him. I think whoever, but she starts getting into this, why there's not a first degree reckless homicide conviction applicable in the situation. excuse me. But then she, so I think that when she does say that sort of thing, coupled with what she does say later on, which is in my brief, I think she does sort of open the door to that sort of an inference that her client is in fact the shooter, but not to the first degree reckless homicide level, as the government had indicated. I think that sort of opens the door, and then, and she basically kind of gets into that whole thing there about sort of alluding that my client was the shooter, but not to the first degree reckless homicide level. And then whoever the shooter is didn't do it to first degree reckless homicide level.
Mr. Rosen, what would you tell us? I thought you were finished. Go ahead, please.
No, I think a reasonable jury could infer that you're saying that it could be your client. It's, you know, it's reasonable, but that not to that level of a greater homicide. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I thought
I'm done.
I thought you were done. Okay, it's hard with Zoom. So what would you have us do with everything else? May I continue, Chief Justice Rodenzack?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Rosen, what would you have us do with everything else that's in the closing argument? Because the rest of the except for the one word, really, that you're asking us to consider, the rest of the closing argument is somebody else did this, right? What I would refer to as the Saudi defense back in the DA's office, right? Some other dude did it. Or that, and or the state hasn't proven that this case beyond a reasonable doubt. That is everything in this closing argument except for the phrase that you're asking us to look at here. What are we supposed to do with the rest of the closing?
Well, I think when you look at the closing, I think as because I think McCoy is pretty broad. I think Ann Bowie, with that respect to that, and I tend to disagree. That wasn't just one word. I think it was the whole. She then lays out why it's not a first degree reckless homicide and argues facts as supporting that, and that you should consider convicting my client of that. Which I think that basically McCoy basically is pretty broad and says you can't do anything like this. You cannot cross the line between what your client wants and what you think is appropriate. And I think that that's where we look at it. Even though there's a front and the back end, he was not guilty, didn't do it. But you throw that in there, that is substantive and material to the point where it crosses the line between what McCoy allows and doesn't allow, which is that in any way, an attorney cannot steer the ship in any way, shape, or form from what the client wants. What the client wanted in this case was absolute innocence for his client to specifically and totally, completely say, argue for me to walk out of here tomorrow a free person, period, because I didn't do this. And I think that by second degree reckless homicide and arguing for that, contrary to what the client wishes, she subjected her client to be convicted of a lesser included offense, albeit a lesser included offense, and she told the jury to consider convicting her client lesser, so he has to do prison time because of this. And that's my position, Your Honor. I don't know if I'm out of time or not.
Yeah, you are, but that's fine to finish your answer to Justice Gorofsky.
Do I still have 5 minutes of rebuttal left, Your Honor?
You do. Yes, you do, Your Honor. You'll come back, Attorney Rosen, at the end for another 5 minutes. Is the state ready to proceed?
I am. Thank you.
Please do.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Scott Rosenow for the state of Wisconsin. McCoy created a narrow exception to the ineffective assistance of counsel framework. McCoy forbids a lawyer from conceding her client's guilt at trial over the client's objection. Case law from around the country finds a concession of guilt where a lawyer asked the jury to convict her client or told the jury that her client was guilty. And neither of those things happened here. Trial counsel Ann Bowie disputed the identity of the shooter. She argued the state had failed to meet its burden of proof, and she ultimately urged the jury to find her client not guilty. I don't think there's any case law anywhere in the country that finds a statement like the one at issue here to be a concession of guilt. I'll briefly talk about the Horn case that Attorney Rosen cited today. I quoted that case in my brief on page 16, and I think the quote really speaks for itself. In the Horn case, the lawyer told the jury, "I'm not asking you to find my client not guilty." Nothing like that happened here. The opposite happened here. Attorney Bowie asked the jury to find her client not guilty. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the statement urging the jury to consider second-degree reckless homicide, because that's what Chambers' argument seems to mostly rely on. So I think the court should consider the totality of the closing argument and should consider that statement in context. And I think looking at it sort of in sequence is really helpful, because Attorney Bowie starts out by trying to undermine the credibility of some of the state's key witnesses. Then she argues that first degree reckless homicide was not proven because the state failed to prove the utter disregard element. And right after making that argument, she says, "You jurors should consider the second degree reckless homicide offense." So I think all that she was doing was telling the jury that it had to follow its instructions. The instructions say, move on to second degree if you don't agree in first degree. And I don't think that counsel conceded guilt by saying that any more than the court would have conceded guilt by giving that instruction in the first place.
Counsel, can we talk about the procedural objection piece that you spent some time on in your brief? Can you help me out in... help me to understand what exactly are you saying Mr. Chambers needed to do here and when? I understand that you're conceding for the purposes of review that he communicated to his attorney that he did not want any concession of guilt. So we have that kind of starting place. And obviously this was decided, you know, merely on the motion without a hearing. So we'll sort of take that for what it is. What exactly are you saying he had to do something on the record? Are you saying he had to do something with his attorney? I'm trying to figure out how you'd craft, what kind of rule you're asking us to adopt, and again, why that would be.
Right. So I think that Chambers should have said something to his attorney at the very least. Ideally, he should have said something to the trial court after the jury left the courtroom when it retired to deliberate.
Both of those or either of those?
Well, I think he should have told his lawyer something like, "Hey, why did you concede my guilt? I didn't want you to do that." And then the lawyer could have raised the issue with the court. If the lawyer failed to say something, then I think it would be incumbent on Chambers personally to say something to the court.
So it would be enough not to put something on the record, but what you're asking for is a separate second communication with his attorney that you didn't do what we agreed upon doing. So if I'm understanding you correctly, if a client says to his attorney, "I definitely, you know, do not concede my guilt under any circumstances. That's what I want for my defense." You're saying that that wouldn't be enough to preserve a McCoy claim unless he subsequently realizes his attorney may have done what he said he didn't want to happen.
I think the objection has to be communicated to the court, similar to how it was in the McCoy case itself. In that case, there was a clear concession of guilt during the opening statement. And then once the jury left the courtroom after the opening statements were done, the defendant objected to the court about the concession of guilt. So I think something similar should have happened here after closing argument.
Well, why? I mean, McCoy, you know, didn't really discuss this, right? I mean, I understand under the facts of the record, you had that happen. So I'm trying to figure out why that would be, because McCoy seems to be premised, it's not, you know, an ineffective assistance type claim, right? It's McCoy is premised on almost, you know, your ethical obligations as an attorney to represent your client, and that being sort of at the root of what the Sixth Amendment would require here. So I'm trying to figure out why a defendant would need to say something more than communicate his clear goals and limits for what he wants argued in defense than a clear communication to his attorney of that. Why wouldn't that be enough under, beyond the fact that McCoy had facts that he did object to the record? I'm starting to figure out sort of at a first principles level why we would require something else.
Right. So I suppose I could take a step back a little bit, and that might help provide context for my answer. So I think it's important to look at the Florida versus Nixon case, also the McCoy case. And I think interestingly, both of those decisions were authored by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I think she strove to really make the two decisions consistent with each other. And the McCoy decision distinguishes the Nixon decision. And the key distinguishing fact between the two is that in Nixon, the defendant did not object to the concession of guilt until after he was convicted. But in McCoy, there were objections before trial and then even at the start of trial after the opening statements were made. So I think one possible reading of those two decisions is that there doesn't have to be a contemporaneous objection. All there has to be is some sort of instruction to the lawyer to maintain innocence, and that this sort of objection is just kind of built into the, I guess, framework of the analysis. In other words, the merits analysis considers whether there's an objection or an instruction to the defense lawyer.
But Nixon, I thought, I mean, it seemed like, you know, the import of Nixon was he never said anything at any point in time. And it's distinguished in the McCoy case that Nixon never asserted any such objective to that. He said, Ford versus Nixon is not to the contrary. Justice Ginsburg wrote, Nixon's attorney did not negate Nixon's autonomy by overriding Nixon's desired defense objective, for Nixon never asserted any such objective. Nixon was generally unresponsive during discussions of trial strategy, never verbally approved or protested counsel's proposed approach. Nixon complained about the admission of guilt only after trial, while as McCoy did it at every opportunity. So it doesn't seem like, at least reading that language, it doesn't seem like the McCoy case is requiring an objection on the record necessarily, that Nixon is distinguishable because his client never communicated that that was the objective before the operative time. And that we're sort of in a different world maybe here where we, at least under the facts of this case, potentially.
Right. And that, just to be clear, I don't think that Nixon or McCoy requires a contemporaneous objection on the record. I think that's just a procedural rule, a common law rule that Wisconsin uses and federal courts use it too, but I don't think that's part of the constitutional analysis. So I would like to talk about the autonomy, right, a little bit. I'm glad that Your Honor quoted that language because it's where I wanted to go next. So I think that if a defendant does what the defendant in Nixon did, doesn't assert his innocence, doesn't tell his lawyer what to do, then in that instance, a defendant did not assert his autonomy right to pursue an art acquittal, did not assert his right to maintain innocence. So in that case, when a defense lawyer concedes guilt, that concession is not in violation of the client's autonomy because the client never asserted his autonomy. But I think under McCoy, there were discussions before trial between defense counsel and defendant saying, I want you to maintain my innocence throughout trial. So in that case, there was an assertion of autonomy, and it was violated right during the opening statement when the lawyer said, my client's guilty. So I think the threshold issue is there an assertion of autonomy? And I think it was footnote one in my brief where I concede for purposes of this appeal that Chambers adequately told his lawyer before trial, pursue an acquittal, pursue innocence. So I think the McCoy right is sort of triggered under that autonomy kind of threshold question. But the next question is, did the defendant say something to the trial court when the alleged concession happened? And I don't think that sort of objection is required under McCoy or Nixon as a sort of constitutional matter. I think it's just a procedural waiver or forfeiture rule. Admittedly, the Nixon case is a little bit unclear, maybe, because it does seem to talk about waiver principles, but then also seems to say you never asserted your autonomy in the first place. So I think one fair reading is that an objection on the record at the time of the concession is not required, but the state's advocating a different reading, saying that McCoy and Nixon establishes autonomy right. That right is separate and distinct from the forfeiture rule, which does require timely objection. So I think they're two different things, but there is admittedly some overlap or gray area.
So just, I just want to summarize, and I want to make sure I understand your argument correctly. Your argument is that neither McCoy nor the Constitution require the sort of forfeiture on the record objection necessarily that you're arguing for. You're arguing for that in the nature of a rule of judicial administration that you think would be helpful and effective to administering McCoy claims moving forward.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
I
want to follow up on that. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Justice Scott.
Okay. If I may just follow up then. Practically speaking, if you're in the middle of a closing in a trial and the jury's in the box and the defense attorney is arguing, what I am hearing you say is that if a defendant maintaining his or her innocence and that defendant believes that the defense attorney's arguments are inconsistent with that defense, that it is up to the defendant at that moment of time when the jury perhaps is still in the jury box listening to closings to interrupt his or her attorney and say something to the fact that you're not arguing what we said you would argue. I mean, this just, if I'm thinking about it, would cause a huge disruption in the court. If I were the trial court judge, I might not know what is happening because I would be very surprised that the defendant is talking. It could even surprise a bailiff in the courtroom who may think that there is going to be the start of some sort of commotion. Certainly the members of the jury are going to think, what is going on here? It doesn't seem like a very practical way to preserve an objection. If we think about forfeiture rules, and you have this on page 13 of your brief, that forfeiture rules are there. The first thing you say is that we want to raise an issue at the trial court to correct or avoid an alleged error in the first place. Well, in this case, it would have already been, the bell would have already been rung. The defense attorney would have already said what the defendant didn't want said. And as you and I know, sometimes people don't object to things because they don't want to highlight it. It just seems to be like there's just a whole mess of problems with what you're suggesting. Could you respond to some of those, please?
Sure. So I think, first of all, I don't think the client would be required to object in the jury's presence. I think the ideal situation would be the defendant would object out of the jury's earshot, just like that's what happened in McCoy right after opening statements. When the jury left, that's when the client said something about the concession of guilt. So I think the same sort of thing would happen here. And I think as a practical matter, sometime after the jury leaves the courtroom to go deliberate, but before they come back with their verdict, that's when the objection should happen, when there's still time to remedy the situation. And I think especially in this sort of case, when the alleged concession is at most an ambiguous statement considered in isolation, then I think in that kind of case, the lawyer can clarify, they can bring the jury back or send a note to the jury room and say, hey, I wasn't conceding anything. I wasn't asking you to convict my client. Here's what I meant. So hopefully they can create a record on it. They can tell the jury what was meant.
How is any defendant going to know that they're supposed to do this? Right. I mean, the defendant is sitting next to an attorney who's protecting all of their constitutional rights. How is any defendant going to know that the attorney is responsible for 99.999% of what is going to happen in the courtroom? But you all need to know before this trial starts that if your attorney starts to argue something that is inconsistent with you maintaining your innocence, then it's on you to object. I don't see how that would possibly work.
Well, with all due respect, I think a lot of defendants would be savvy enough or wise enough to say something. The defendant in McCoy was savvy enough to say something to the court. And I think when the whole issue at trial is, will the jury convict me or not? And I told my lawyer to pursue an acquittal and he told the jury to convict me. I think that's going to raise a huge red flag to even perhaps a least intelligent defendant out there, because that's what the whole trial is about. So I think defendants often will raise this issue when they in fact did tell their lawyer to pursue innocence and when the lawyer says something inconsistent with that. I believe Justice not to cut you off, Justice Kratzky, if you're not done, but I think Justice Dallet wanted to ask me something a minute ago, maybe.
Well, my questions are along the lines of Justice Kratzky's. I'm just also listening to you talk about this idea, not sure about how this would actually apply in a forfeiture setting. Usually that is set up to cure, and I don't know that your ideas about how it would be cured would actually work in a situation like this. It might get into attorney-client privilege about what they talked about, and I mean, it just opens up a whole side issue that can just as easily be dealt with after the fact, right? I mean, how do you respond to that, that this just doesn't seem to fit into forfeiture as a concept?
I think that is a reasonable view, that forfeiture maybe just doesn't seem to kind of fit the facts here, because it's kind of unusual to expect the defendant personally to say something. Usually it's incumbent on the lawyer to speak for the defendant. But I suppose in this kind of case, it's the defense lawyer making the mistake in disagreement with the defendant's preferred strategy. So this, I think in the state's view, this is one of the unusual situations where the defendant personally should say something. But I will admit that I think it's reasonable to think that maybe forfeiture just isn't a good fit for this kind of situation, and that perhaps all that's required under McCoy and Nixon, at least, is an instruction to pursue an innocence defense. And once the defendant makes that clear before trial, then perhaps he doesn't have to say anything more later. I'll admit that is a reasonable view. I don't think it's not the state's view, but it is reasonable. I'm not going to dispute that much.
Just to take that horse and maybe beat it a little bit further here, it's kind of odd that you would say an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, a Sixth Amendment claim, can't be forfeited, but this structural error Sixth Amendment claim can be. That seems odd, from a doctrinal standpoint and looking at kind of consistency in the way we treat like claims. If someone's Sixth Amendment right is violated by ineffective assistance, and that, you know, there's no obligation that the person who received that assistance needs to say something about it. It seems even more odd that you would require that when we don't even get to prejudice or things like that. It's just a structural error situation predicated upon the same constitutional right.
Sure. So a couple of things in response. A few years ago in the Pinnell case, this court held that a violation of the right to a public trial, which is a structural error, can be forfeited due to the lack of a timely objection. And the U.S. Supreme Court held the same thing a few years later in Weaver versus Massachusetts. So even structural errors can be forfeited. And I think honestly, the structural error nature of a claim perhaps weighs more in favor of finding it forfeited, because there's more of a potential for sandbagging, where a savvy defendant or perhaps savvy defense lawyer could think, I'll get an automatic reversal if I don't say anything and raise this issue on appeal if my client gets convicted. One other point, though, before we move on, hopefully. I think the reason why ineffective assistance claims are not forfeited is because that is one framework for viewing a forfeited claim. Oftentimes, the defendant is arguing that his lawyer should have objected to evidence, for example, and the objection is forfeited, which is why it's treated as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So I think that's maybe why IAC claims are treated differently, because that's the framework for viewing the forfeited issue. And just to make clear, even if this court finds this claim forfeited, that doesn't mean the court can't consider it. All it means is that the court can exercise its discretion not to consider the merits if it wants to because of the forfeiture. But like you said, Justice Hagedorn, forfeiture is a rule of judicial administration. It's not a jurisdictional rule or anything like that. So a court can ignore a forfeiture if it wants to in this type of situation and go straight to the merits. And perhaps that's the most prudent course in this case. This court oftentimes decides cases on the narrowest possible grounds and decides just one dispositive issue instead of other issues. So perhaps the most prudent way to resolve this case is just to do what the circuit court and court of appeals did and just reject the McCoy claim on the merits because there was no concession of guilt, and then just leave it at that. I will talk more about forfeiture if there are more questions, but I would like to spend
some time. Actually, I have a question on a different topic, as much as I'm sure you want to talk about forfeiture for the remainder of your time. Let me ask you a question. Justice Hagedorn asked Mr. Rosen a question about alternative arguments. And if I understood Mr. Rosen's response, his was that alternative arguments are inconsistent with the holding in McCoy. I think that's different than what is in your brief. So I wanted to hear what your response was to the alternative arguments proposition.
Well, Justice Kravsky, you read my mind. That's exactly where I wanted to go next. So I think that...
I'm sorry. I think we may have lost Justice Dallet.
That's all right. She's still hearing. We are going to continue. Okay. She's still able to hear us, even though we can't always see her.
Okay. Thank you.
So I do think that an alternative argument, even the one that may, the kind that might have happened here, is permissible under McCoy. Just to take a step back first, I think there might be two ways to reasonably interpret this consider comment that trial counsel made. The state's reading of that argument, I think I laid out several minutes ago today, that I think all that Attorney Bowie meant was find utter disregard lacking, so reject first degree reckless homicide, then move on to consider second degree and reject that lesser charge because the state didn't prove the identity of the shooter. I think that's all she meant. But I will admit that a second, less reasonable, but perhaps still reasonable reading of the closing argument is that perhaps Attorney Bowie was saying, my client's not guilty of anything, but if he's guilty of something, it's second degree reckless homicide. Again, I don't think that's what she meant, but that is perhaps a reasonable reading of what she meant. And if that is what she meant, that's still okay under McCoy versus Louisiana. I cited some case law to that effect in my brief from North Carolina and a post-McCoy Louisiana case. Justice Hagedorn referred to a Ninth Circuit case, which I think was called, it's not cited in the briefs because it's very recent. I think it's 3 weeks old, so I won't argue about it because that's maybe unfair to Attorney Rosen. But it's called Christian versus Thomas, 982 F3rd 1215. Again, that's a Ninth Circuit case. And admittedly, that one might be a little different here because the alternative argument was a self-defense argument, which still would result in an acquittal. But I think the same idea holds true in this case as in the Ninth Circuit case, that if the main argument is outright acquittal and the alternative argument is conviction on some lesser offense, that's still not a concession. That's just an alternative argument. In this case, for example, the state's made a few different alternative arguments. I just made one a minute ago that you should read Attorney Bowie's statements this way, but if you read them some other way, they're still okay. That's not a concession that you should read them the second way. It's just saying, if you reject my main argument, you should consider my second argument. So I think
what Attorney Rosen's point is yes, I'm not sure you would disagree with what you just said. And Attorney Rosen, you'll correct me when you come back if I'm misstating what your position is. But he's saying, look, in this circumstance, you can't even go there. This is black or white. Either he did it or he didn't do it. And it doesn't, there's no gray in between. And so do you agree with that under McCoy? Do you agree with that reading under McCoy?
No, I don't agree with that reading. I think that the defendant under McCoy has the autonomy right to choose the objective of the defense. And if the objective is an outright acquittal, then it has to be the objective that the lawyer pursues. So that it doesn't mean that the lawyer is unfree to pursue alternative objectives or alternative arguments. I think all it means is that the main objective has to be the outright acquittal that the client is seeking. And in this case, I think it's pretty clear from the entire closing argument that Attorney Bowie's, I think frankly her sole argument, but at the very least her primary argument was, find my client not guilty. And in fact, she never conceded that her client was the shooter, and she never even conceded that he was present at the shooting. So in light of those facts, I really don't see how she could have possibly conceded his guilt of being the shooter without even saying he was at the shooting. So I don't think there's a concession of guilt anywhere. But again, even if the court reads her closing argument as being an alternative argument, I still think it's okay to make that kind of alternative argument. Like in this case, the state is arguing for an affirmance or at the very least a remand for an evidentiary hearing instead of a trial. That's not a concession that there should be a remand. It's just an argument that if you reject my main argument for affirmance, you should remand for a hearing. It's the same kind of thing. Lawyers make alternative arguments all the time on appeal and at trial. Oftentimes there are inconsistent or alternative defenses being raised. And I think that McCoy allows that sort of thing to happen. if the lawyer were forbidden under McCoy from addressing the lesser included offenses, then there's a good chance that he would have been convicted of first degree reckless homicide instead of second degree. Of course, I'm not suggesting that the lawyer is free to say convict him of second degree, but that's not what she said. All she said was second degree is something you should consider. And she made that statement in context of saying utter disregard is not proven, which means first degree is not proven. So under your instructions, you should move on to second degree next. But I think what's key is she never, once she got to talking about second degree reckless homicide, she never said he's guilty of that. She never said he was the shooter. She never said to convict him. Once she started talking about second degree, that's when she said the real issue, the big decision for the jury to make is deciding the identity of the shooter. Who is the shooter? And that's when she got back to talking about the state's key witnesses, said they weren't believable, tried to poke holes in their defense, hid behind the state's burden of proof and said beyond a reasonable doubt is a very high burden. And in the end, she said, find my client not guilty. Those were her final words to the jury, find him not guilty. So I think read in context, she never even made an alternative argument. I think all she did was repeated the court's jury instructions, move on from first degree to second degree, and then reject second degree because identity is not proven. I think that's all she did and all she meant, which is obviously fine under McCoy.
Counsel, do you agree with your opposing counsel that trial attorney had affirmatively indicated to the trial court if I'm reading this correctly, that there was an absolute innocence defense.
Whether the trial attorney indicated to the court or whether the defendant did?
If I'm reading this brief correctly, it states in page 3, prior to the jury trial, the defendant had rejected all plea offers. His trial attorney had affirmatively indicated to the trial court that his client was asserting absolute innocence. Also, your opposing counsel referenced that in his remarks this morning. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's footnote 1 of my brief probably covers that issue or answers that question. So I think that in order to even trigger the sort of autonomy right under McCoy, the defendant has to tell his lawyer, I want you to pursue innocence.
Yes.
And I think that for purposes of this appeal, the state is just conceding that he did make that instruction.
I noted your footnote. This is my concern. In my read of the closing arguments of defense counsel, I don't see in closing arguments that defense counsel says my client didn't do it. I see instead a disparaging of the evidence offered, an emphasis of beyond a reasonable doubt as the standard, and thus concluding you must find my client not guilty. Not because there's one sentence in that closing argument, unless I missed it, that says my client did not do it, absolutely innocent. Instead, the argument is the state hasn't proven it beyond a reasonable doubt, therefore you must find not guilty. Isn't there some tension then, since you've just acknowledged that trial counsel had affirmatively indicated to the trial court that his client was asserting absolute innocence? In footnote 5 of your brief, you indicate that you don't need a contemporaneous objection or even maybe one at trial, that if it's done before trial to the trial court, that might be sufficient. So I guess I have both part of the when question yet lingering in my mind. This is before trial. You've acknowledged that trial counsel alerted the trial court before trial. And the read in full, the closing argument doesn't assert absolute innocence. It says, aha, state, you can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. If you'd respond to that reading, please.
Sure. So McCoy gives the defendant the right to decide the objective. And may I finish my answer?
Yes, please finish answering the question.
Thank you. So McCoy gives the defendant the right to choose the objective of the defense, which here was outright acquittal. But McCoy also gives the lawyer the ability to decide how best to achieve that objective. So the lawyer gets to decide the strategy. So I think in this case, Justice Bradley, the defense lawyer gets to choose whether to get up to the jury and say, my client is innocent, he didn't do it, or instead to pursue the same objective by sort of watering down the rhetoric a little bit and saying, the state didn't prove that he did it. I think those two things are functionally the same because they're pursuing the same objective of defense. And I think that this lawyer, her sort of consider comment, it wasn't consider convicting my client as Attorney Rosen reads it. It was consider whether he did it, consider whether to convict him, and you should not convict him because the state didn't prove that he did it. So I think that's what she meant. And I think that's okay under McCoy too.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Attorney Rosen, are you ready for a rebuttal?
I am, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you.
Please begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to what Judge Bradley just said, it's at page 7 of my brief. Ms. Bowie did indicate to the court the final pretrial, but Mr. Chambers has been clear from the day he got arrested that he did not do this. He wasn't going to plead guilty no matter what, and that's his position today. So I think that takes that situation to where we are. What I think the state is sort of waffling around with this is that somehow it's okay to sort of say consider without really saying conceding guilt to the lesser included. I mean, Ms. Bowie argued facts as to why the second degree recklessness included should be it. And Judge Bradley said she never really said, counsel never really said he didn't do it. I mean, my client never agreed to spend 12 years of his life in prison as initial confinement. He wanted to get out that day. And I think Ms. Counsel, basically through her language, basically agreed with the court, with the state, that that was an appropriate resolution through her language. And I think we can take the words consider, but I think when you say consider before a jury trial, this isn't like saying consider remanding or not remanding or finding in favor of one. It's basically saying you should consider this charge when you go back to deliberate because this more sufficiently fits the facts. When you consider whether to convict my client or not, and she said, this is how you should approach this, lesser included, because that's what this reflects. She never said my client didn't do it. She said the facts fit this more, sort of inferring, and I think it's pretty clear that this is what he should be convicted of. I don't think there's any way to avoid that, and I don't think there's any waffling about that because she did argue the shot, or this wasn't just a blatant, this wasn't just a simple consider this. She argued specific facts as to why the jury should argue, find that the utter disregard language hadn't been met, that element hadn't been met. And she argued the shot spotter alerts and that there was crossfire and it was dark and nobody could figure out who shot first or second. And that was comes in there in terms of where she considered. There's no reason to give that sort of language and to make those sorts of arguments unless you're arguing to the jury, hey, this is what my client did. That's what just gets me about this is there's no real reason to argue this sort of lesser included language unless you're sort of telling the jury my client should be convicted of this. Otherwise, what's the point? Otherwise, if your client just didn't do it at all, just had nothing to do with this, you just stick with the not guilty, say my client didn't do this and here's why. When you start throwing this out language about that, that's the only reason to do this as to why you should do this and to cut his losses. So I think that that's where that consider language comes in terms of, I think a reasonable inference, and I think with all due respect to the court, is to say, consider convicting my client of this lesser included. Otherwise, like I said, why make this argument, this alternative argument? And I think the alternative argument issue is clearly precluded by McCoy. I don't think any counsel now subsequent to McCoy, when the client specifically and adamantly says at the very beginning throughout trial and never changes his position. He said at the beginning of the trial, I didn't do this. My client didn't do this and never changed his position. I don't see why he now has to say, hey, you know, I told everybody I didn't do it. He made his position clear at the beginning, I didn't do this, as to why all of a sudden there has to be that sort of issue with that. He's not a lawyer. The record had already been made that he hadn't done it. The record had already been made that he was not guilty of this and he didn't do this, as I just read to the court, as page 7 of my brief said. So once again, I think the basic issue is that why would an attorney at closing argument tell the jury to consider the lesser included and give facts as to why the lesser included is applicable in the situation, unless that attorney is conceding guilt and telling the jury to consider convicting my client of this. Otherwise, it just doesn't make any sense. One other thing I did notice is that from what I read with Mr. Rose and I, he did make a statement, and correct me if I'm wrong. He did say that trial counsel had made a mistake. This was the words, quote, made a mistake, unquote, in her statement to the jury about the closing argument with what is at issue here. So I think that's what I wrote down. The only objective with respect to alternative arguments is what the client wants. What was clearly laid out in this case here is the client wanted absolute acquittal. He wanted to go home. And I think for the reasons I indicated now and during my briefs and all, the whole throughout the course of the proceedings, counsel's conduct had violated that. And I think the only way to consider that this case is to consider the only reason she gave that argument, and there's all the reason why she gave the argument as an issue in this case, is because she wanted the jury to consider convicting her client of that lesser included, and that is the functional equivalent of conceding guilt. And that's, with no further questions, I'm done, Your Honor.
Yeah, thank you very much. I want both attorneys to know that Justice Dallet has been in and out. We know she's been out visually for a while. She was in regard to voice, but I've received word from my technical people that she's been off voice as well. This hearing was recorded, and Justice Dallet will have the recording and an opportunity to review that before the court meets in closed conference to discuss this case further. So I wanted to let you know what I know at this particular point in time. I'm not sure how much she missed. I wrote down 10:42 on my computer when I got the note that she was out voice-wise as well as visually. So it was near the end of the argument, but she will have the opportunity to review the entire transcript, and I will not call for a closed conference until she's had the opportunity to listen to anything she wasn't personally here to participate in. So, you know, Zoom is great when it works, but when it doesn't, it's really, you have to kind of do the best you can. So I thank you both for fine arguments and for working with the court as we're still trying to get up to regular presentations. Hopefully that'll be the case by the time we get around to next fall. But thank you so much for participating, and thank you for fine briefs and very well-placed arguments. We are going to adjourn now to get ready for our second argument of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.